There is another aspect to reality that is yet to be explained. So we know the aspect of reality that we've already explained, which is the creation, the origin of reality. But now we want to expand on morality in general. You know, can anybody give me a description of what they believe morality is or what morality deals with? Anybody want to give a shot? Knowing the difference between right and wrong. Yep. And there's a little bit more to that. Morality deals with the distinctions or the principles concerning the distinctions between right or wrong, as well as good or bad. And we're going to get into how do we distinguish between right, wrong, good, and bad. Now, it seems that in this world, at least, that we deal with moral issues every single day. We deal with right or wrong, good or bad issues every single day. Now, we have to ask ourselves a question. Does the presence of morals point to the existence of God? Or is it safe to say that we can explain morality without God? Or we can ask it in this simple question. Can we be good without God? And at this point, it's necessary to pause for a bit. So we ask the question, can we be good without God? Now, it's going to be inevitable when you guys are out evangelizing, you know, in whatever location. And if you were to ask an atheist this question, can we be good without God? Or how can we be good without God? It's inevitable that some confusion may arise. They'll probably respond by saying, what are you talking about? I don't believe in God and I'm good every single day. I have...
What is good?
Exactly. You can ask that question. And they might retort, you know, I have tons of friends. I mean, even look at atheists, famous atheists that are doing a lot of good. They participate in charities or they own charities or stuff like that. They don't have God and they're good. What do you mean, can we be good without God? So there's a little confusion here. Well, I want to tell you is that's not what the question is asking. The question is not asking if one can be good without belief in God. The question is asking rather, can we be good without God himself, without the existence of God? So this question is actually focusing not on the belief about morality, but on the foundation or the justification of moral values. So you can say, you know what, I think I'm a good person. Well, I would ask the atheist, being an atheist, in your worldview, how can you even justify using the word good? How can you even justify the idea of good? So you're asking that atheist, what is the basis? What is the foundation for morals under your worldview? So it's agnostic. We're agnostic about the beliefs about morality. We're asking, what is the foundation? We're going to the root of the matter. Put another way, this question asks explicitly, if God does not exist, can we be good? Notice there's no mention of beliefs in there. And here's where the moral argument steps in. Now, the moral argument attempts to conclude the existence of God from the existence of objective moral values and duties. And we'll get into what all those terms mean in a bit. Now, just like last month, we set up our argument in a syllogism, right? There's two premises and a conclusion, and they have to have logical connection. And that's what we want to do again today. So we want to set up our moral argument in a syllogistic form. And it goes a little something like this. And of course, this might work. Okay, it's not going to work. Really? Okay, good. If God does not exist, then objective moral values and duties do not exist. Longest sentence ever. That's premise one. Premise two, we have to have some sort of logical connection to it. It says, well, objective moral values and duties do exist. Do exist. That's one, two. Our conclusion would be, therefore, can anybody finish it for me? Therefore, God exists. Does anybody recognize the form of this syllogism? There's kind of...
Conditional.
I'm sorry?
Conditional.
Conditional. There's a specific... There's a layer underneath. There's a specific Latin term for the way this argument is set up. And I'll break it down a little simpler here. If P, then Q, not Q, therefore, not P.
Modus tollens.
Modus tollens means the way of denial. So here you have a if P, then Q. If P, God does not exist, then Q, objective moral values and duties do not exist. The second premise is not Q. You're denying Q, the consequent here. And this is valid. So notice that we have a negative already here. And when you negate a negative, you actually get a positive. That's the kind of confusing part here. But we're left with the second premise, not Q, which is actually not, which is positive. Objective moral values and duties do exist. Therefore, not P. Again, we have another negation of a negative, which turns into a positive. Therefore, God does exist. So this is a modus tollens. And the reason I wanted to show you that is to show you that it's logically airtight. It's logically valid. So if an atheist were, or a skeptic in general, were to come across you and say, that argument's garbage, not even set up properly, you can just ask them, show me how. This is logically airtight. But being logically airtight does nothing to prove the conclusion. With any logical argument, what do we have to do? With any syllogism, what do we have to do? We can't simply assert. What do we have to do? We have to give good reasons to show that our premises are true. And then once we do that, we can say, well, if these two premises are true, it logically follows that our conclusion must be true. And that's how we do it. You cannot simply just assert, you know, your premises and say, I win. No, you got to give good reasons. And this is what the apologetics class is all about, right? Giving good reasons for believing what you believe. All right. So before we get into actually analyzing and examining the two premises, I want to take a little moment to pause here. And we're going to unpack these terms that we're using here, objective, moral values and duties. All right, so let's do that. Let's start with values and duties. Now, values have to do with whether something is good or bad. So I think we can kind of conceptualize that. Values have to do with whether something is good or bad, and duties have to do with whether something is right or wrong. Now, you may be thinking that I'm saying the same thing twice, or that this is a distinction without a difference, but let's analyze this a little bit more. And I'll say this, a duty, we mentioned, has to do with right or wrong, but when we mean right or wrong, we're saying it has to deal with moral obligations. So that means it deals with what one ought to do or what one ought not to do. So these are things like you should do this or you should not do this. Think of the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not kind of stuff. These are obligations. These are duties. Now, using having that definition or having that concept in mind, I think we can think of things that are good for us, good values. We can think of things that are good for us, but that we're not necessarily obligated to do. And that's where you see the distinction between values and duties. For instance, it's a good value, for instance, that you should, or not you should, but that you can become a doctor and help the needy, help those who are in pain. It's a good value. It's a good thing to become a doctor, but I'm not obligated to become a doctor. Obviously, I'm a computer guy. I have nothing to do in the medical field. I'm not obligated to become a doctor. If we were, who's a doctor in here? I don't think anybody. So we would all be failing, right? But becoming a doctor is just a good thing. But it's not a duty. We're not obligated to. And so you can, you know, once you have that distinction in mind, you can start thinking of all sorts of things that are good or bad for you, but that you're not necessarily obligated to do or become. Okay? And so that's the crucial distinction between values and duties. Value has to do with the worth of an action or a person, whether it's good or bad, simply. And then duty comes in after and says, well, this is good, this is bad, am I obligated to it in some form or fashion? All right, does anybody have any questions on that distinction? Are we all on the same page here? Okay, well, now we can move on to the word objective and then its cousin, subjective. Has anybody not heard those terms, objective and subjective? Okay, so objective means something that is independent of people's opinions. Independent of people's opinions. So it means no matter what people say. Subjective is the opposite. It means that something is dependent on people's opinions. So it does matter what people say. Think about it this way. Break down the word objective. You know, you just take that root word object. You think of an object that is really there. For instance, this little can right here. It's a can no matter what I think or say or anybody in this room thinks or says about it. You can tell me it's a teddy bear, but you'd be wrong because it's objectively a can. It's outside of us. Now, subjective, it deals a lot more with preferences, your personal preferences. For instance, vanilla is better than chocolate. Now, I would put that in the objective, but you know, that's just me. But subjectively, you're dealing with just your personal preferences. So subject, I'm the subject. I believe personally that vanilla is better than chocolate. I'm the subject. Now, there's different subjects in here, and every single subject in here would have a different opinion about that. So that's the difference there. Subjective depends on people's opinions, but objective, no matter what you say, it's not going to change the reality of what is, right? Yes?
Also under subjective, would you put people's perceptions on things that are objective? That they might hold that this is not just my opinion, this is what I believe to be the fact.
Right.
Even if they might be wrong about it.
So there's different types of statements a person can make. One can make a preferential statement. Your opinionated statement, really. Mm-hmm. And then one can make a statement about reality itself.
A conviction.
One would be, and I have it here under objective, I can say the Holocaust was objectively wrong. Mm-hmm. Right? I am making a statement about reality. And it so happens to line up with reality. It corresponds with reality. So it's not a subjective statement. It's actually an objective statement because it tells me something about reality, and it actually is the fact.
And what makes it objective is the fact that it lines up with reality.
Exactly.
Otherwise, say if somebody, well, let's say Hitler, who instigated the Holocaust, mm-hmm. he had in his mind, this is a good thing. We're doing eugenics, and we can kill a bunch of people because we think they're lower than us. In his mind, he'd be right, but it doesn't line up with
exactly
the truth that God has laid down.
Yep. So, and that's exactly what I had at the rest of this example, is that mm-hmm. an objective statement would be true no matter what anybody else were to think about it. For instance, the Holocaust would still be wrong, even if the Nazis won World War II, and even if they brainwashed the entire world to believe that what they were doing was a good thing. Mm-hmm. They would still be objectively wrong. So no matter what everybody else believes, there's still a standard, there's still something about the reality that doesn't line up with their actions, right? So they would still be wrong.
Mm-hmm. But we would call it not just a preference, but we would call it their beliefs that they were right.
Exactly. And we'll get into that a little bit later.
Okay.
But yes.
So I sidetracked
you. No, it's fine. But this is good. That we're understanding the difference between subjective and objective. So, you know, I mean, think about countless arguments that you guys may have had, and you know I kind of like just debating for debating's sake sometimes when somebody tells me that a certain band is cool or plays good music, and I'm like, no. But ultimately, you know, music is preferential. You know, when you're saying that a band is better than one another, I mean, these are just preferences that you're saying. These are just opinions. So I know some people, you know, like to get really rowdy, and they're like, no, I'm adamant that this band is the best, you know, like, you know, I don't know why they do that, but those would be subjective. So,
but then you've got worldly bands who put in bad in their music.
Right. So it depends on what kind of categories you're throwing out there. Mm-hmm. Okay. Does anybody have any questions about that? The difference between values and duties, and the difference between subjective and objective. Okay. Well, I'd also like to mention that this moral argument that you see here, these two premises and a conclusion, they do pack an existential punch. What I mean by that is this is a pretty strong argument for God's existence. And we're going to, hopefully by the end of this study, you're going to see that it's going to be really effective. And one of the reasons that this is so is when we compare it to the cosmological argument, for instance, nobody wakes up on a daily basis and thinks, man, I wonder how the reality of the universe is going to impact my daily life. You know, I wonder how the existence or the beginning of time is really going to impact me today. But when it comes to morality, we do wake up. And just by the simple fact of us living out our lives, we have to make moral decisions on a daily basis. And so the fact that morality exists, that there's good, bad, right, wrong, and we have to make decisions on a daily basis, this argument will impact us directly. So that's what I think whenever you're talking to somebody and you bring up the moral argument, I think you'll kind of get eyebrows raised or, you know, ears perked more often than not, because this is an argument that deals with people's lives directly, the way they live. And you'll see, hopefully at the end, it's going to be very effective. Now, As we mentioned, we got to give reasons for the premises to be true. So that's what we're going to start off with. Now I'm going to go through premise one. We're going to examine it, analyze it, answer some questions, some objections. And after that, we'll take a little break. So, you know, we won't have to go there the full hour or something. But let's go through premise one first. If God does not exist, then objective moral values and duties do not exist. Now, I want to look first at moral values. So values are good, bad distinction. And let's see if moral values do require God. Now, traditionally, moral values have had their basis in God, since God has traditionally been thought to be the ultimate good. So you just point to God, oh, it doesn't line up with God, it's bad. If it does, it's good. And that's been traditional view. But what would be the basis for moral values if we take God out of the picture? Remember, we're not talking about beliefs. We're talking about if God does not exist, what would be the basis for moral values? Now, in order to do this, we have to consider alternative explanations that have been brought up throughout history and see how they fare. And the first one I want to bring up is naturalism. Naturalism is right now kind of the most popular view in atheism. So if you're an atheist, you're going to tend to be a naturalist. And what that means is a naturalist is naturalism is the view that the only reality or the only things that exist or are true are things that can be verified by science or science experiments or scientific theories. And what that really relegates you to is just matter, physical matter. So because scientific method only really deals with the observable universe, things that you can taste, touch, feel, smell, and all that. I think I mentioned two senses at once. But yeah, you're going to be relegated to matter here. Now, of course, that makes sense. If you're an atheist, you can't have God, a transcendent being, in the equation anywhere. So it makes sense that they would only deal with physical things. But the interesting thing is that when you're doing science, when you're performing science experiments, science has nothing or can tell you nothing about morality. For instance, science can tell me that if I hit somebody in just the right spot on the head, that they're going to die. It can describe to me, you know, all the physics and all the medical stuff that's going on when I hit somebody in the head in just the right spot and why they pass out and why they ultimately perish. But it cannot tell me why doing that to somebody for fun is bad. You get the distinction there? I've never heard a scientist tell me, in a science class at least, you know, oh, check out this experiment. Let's put some dry ice and let's put a human baby and let's see what happens. You know, it doesn't tell you anything about morality. It can tell you that the baby will freeze to death, but it won't tell you that doing that is a bad thing. Science is outside the purview of morals. They're totally separate. If you want to go beyond the realm of science and talk about morals, then you're in the realm of philosophy. But unfortunately for naturalism, what they've done is just kind of cut out every other way of gaining knowledge, for instance, philosophy or even history. They've cut out all those and they just said, what can I test? What can I observe now? That's what's real to me. And so it doesn't make sense for them to even talk about morality. But they do. And what will happen is that the naturalist will ultimately have to say that morality is just an illusion. Because morality, you cannot reduce morality, good, bad things, to physical properties. How much does good weigh? What is the color of bad? These things are categorically different. It doesn't make sense to talk about morals in this way. So ultimately, morality, good, bad, moral values, are illusions under naturalism. They do not exist objectively. But let's assume, though, that the atheist claims that moral values are the result of biological evolution and social conditions. And that's the name of the game, right? If you're an atheist, there's no God directing a process. There's no God as the designer.
Can you say that again, please?
Let's say that the atheist is claiming that moral values are the result of biological evolution and social conditions or social pressure. Now, let's think about this for a second. I mentioned evolution, if God does not exist, evolution by natural selection is the current leading explanation, if you're an atheist. Now, under this view, moral values like cooperation, for it's good to cooperate with one another and achieve a common goal, and self-sacrificial behavior. So if I see a little lady crossing the street and she's about to get run over by a semi, self-sacrificing would be me putting myself in harm's way in order to save the little old lady crossing the street about to get hit. So these are good moral values. But under the naturalistic view, this type of behavior would be advantageous for survival, just like in a pack of lions. So think of the animal kingdom, a pack of lions. One of the cubs, you know, gets surrounded by a herd of buffalo or something, and it's about to get attacked. Well, mama and daddy lion don't like that. And guess what? They're going to, for survival benefits, not because they think, oh man, these water buffalo are bullying my cub. No, they want to survive. They're going to step in. They're going to try to do something about that because it's advantageous for survival. They want their kin to survive, and they want their seed to spread and exist for future generations. Now, given that under this view, we're all animals, right? Because it's just evolution. We're just the cousins of primates. We're all animals under this view. So then for Homo sapiens, which is what we are, moral values would originate the same way. So it'd be humans would be behaving in this way. It would be like a herd morality. So the fact that we're here together existing peacefully, we're cooperating with one another, we might exhibit self-sacrificial behavior in some points. For us, at least, because we're Christians, we believe that we're doing it because we believe they're actually good things to do. But under evolutionary or a naturalistic worldview, they believe that we would exhibit that type of behavior simply because of its survival advantage. Because we somehow just want to survive. We're just looking out for number one. All right, so if you take that view then, there's nothing, it says nothing about that behavior being objectively good. Because remember, the water buffalo, in that example with the lions, they surrounded that cub. For them, that was their survival advantage. That was the behavior they have to exhibit in order to survive. They have to eat. And what are they going to do? They're going to find the weakest link. And they're going to surround it and kill it and eat it. So for them, that's subjectively good. It's a good survival technique. But for the lions, a good survival technique would be to kill all the buffalo so they have no other predators. You know what I'm saying? So you really can't tell under the naturalistic view if you're just an animal and animals just kind of behave in such a way to give an advantage for their survival rate. There's really no objectivity to this behavior. There really are no objective moral values. It's just kind of, you know, everybody's looking out for number one. You're doing what you do just to survive. There's really no objectivity to that. Now, the kicker here is that as humans, though, you know, under the atheistic view, you'll hear that atheists sometimes say that as humans, we're the more evolved species. You know, we are capable of reasoning, and that gives us the right to have dominion over the animals or something like that. Well, I hear what they're saying, but truly, under the atheistic view, under the naturalistic view, it doesn't make sense. That's a sort of speciesism. You're basically asserting that your species, the Homo sapiens, are greater than any other species in the world. For instance, like ant or an orangutan or a rhinoceros or anything like that. You're kind of just asserting, yeah, Homo sapiens are the greatest. What basis do you have for making an assertion like that? That species, that's the moral equivalent to racism, right? Racism is saying, well, white man is the best, and I just kind of believe that. You know, there's not really a good reason. And under an atheistic view, there's really not a way to tell which species would be on top. It's just whoever has the power at that moment, for some reason they think it's objectively true, but it's not. And so that's where naturalism would fail, is everyone's on a level playing field. Everyone's just kind of playing to the tune of evolution. So there's no real objective way of distinguishing between moral values. So there are no moral values under naturalism. Does anybody have any questions about that? Well, now let's move on to moral duties. Now remember, duties have to deal with our obligations. What we ought or ought not to do, okay? Now traditionally, moral duties were thought to come from God's commandments. Think of the Ten Commandments. So whenever God spoke the Ten Commandments, at that moment, we as humans were obligated to submit ourselves under those Ten Commandments and obey those Ten Commandments. Now, again, let's take God out of the picture. Let's say God does not exist. What would be the foundation? What would be the basis for moral obligations? Now, remember, on the atheistic view, we're animals. We're continuing on with that theme of, under the atheistic view, we're just animals like everyone else or everything else. Now, when you look at the animal kingdom, you notice that no animal really has a moral obligation to another animal. And here are a couple examples that you want to consider. When the lion kills a zebra, it just kills the zebra. It doesn't murder it. So even as humans today, we look at the animal kingdom and we see the lion kill the zebra. We don't call the safari police and report a murder. No, we say that's part of the animal kingdom because they are animals and that's the way they survive. Now, when a shark forcibly copulates with a female, it forcibly copulates with her. It doesn't rape her. You know, we don't call Neptune and tell him, hey, you got to control that ocean over there. There's a lot of raping going on. No, that's the animal kingdom. That's the way they live. There's no moral obligations for animals. So we, you know, at least today, we don't view the animal kingdom with a moral dimension. We just say, oh, that's what goes on in order for them to survive. So if God does not exist, you know, where do we get our moral obligations from? We have to ask the question, who or what imposes these moral duties on us? It seems that under the atheist view, you're always going to be stuck with the cosmic question, says who? All right, say for instance, you ask the question, who's going to obligate me to do anything? And then Clark may come along and say, oh, I do. I'm going to obligate you. Let me give you a list of rules. And then all I'm going to tell Clark is, says who? Who gave you the... I'm pushing the question one step further. Who gave you the duty to do that? Who gave you the obligation to give me obligations? Because you're just a human being like me. You're fallible. You're not the standard of good. Well, let's say an entire society comes together and they tell me in a forum, Reuben, we've come together as a society and we're going to give you obligations on how to live. Again, I can say, says who? What makes you as a society better than the society over here and across the pond? What society is better? Which society am I going to pick? And again, even if the whole world came to me and told me, Reuben, we're going to obligate you to do these things. These are a list of rules you have to obey. Again, I can ask, says who? Who gave you, the entire world, the obligation? Who gave you that authority? You're fallible people just like me. So I can always push that question one step further. Under the atheistic view, there is no moral obligation. We're just all animals abiding by the rules of the animal kingdom. So it seems that atheism really has some philosophical problems on its hand. Now, moral values, it seems that they require an unchanging and transcendent basis. Just as I pointed to Clark and said, you're fallible just like me. Every person on the face of the planet is fallible. That's why we need to find a basis for morality or moral values outside of the human race, at least. Outside of this world. It has to be transcendent. It has to be unchanging. Clark's mind changes on a daily basis. Who's to say that his mind's not going to change tomorrow and his obligations to me will be different? He's fallible. So under an atheistic view, that's what happens. So there's really no moral, there's no basis. It has to be unchanging and transcendent. Moral duties require an ultimate personal lawgiver. Think of the laws that we pass here in the state of Texas, or even anywhere in the United States. There's legislators that get together and they determine what laws are going to be passed. So the laws that are in place today were sometime in the past given by a lawgiver. Does that make sense? There was a lawgiver at one point. A lawgiver is a person. It wasn't some abstraction. It wasn't a computer that kind of randomly just came up with a law. No, there was a person who debated about it, pondered on the things, and then they came to a conclusion. So even if our legislative laws, if our civil laws here require lawgiver, how much more the moral law? The moral law imposes an obligation on us, and we can only be obligated to people. It doesn't make sense for us to be obligated to an idea, right? We have to be obligated to a person. So that's why we say that moral duties require a personal lawgiver. Now, at this point, it looks like the atheist has only two other options available to justify moral values and duties without God. And so at this point, the atheist might say, well, you know what? Moral values and duties just exist. They're just brute facts about the universe. So, again, we can kind of go back to the cosmological argument and say, well, the Big Bang happened, the existence of the universe came into being, and along with stars, galaxies, elements, and all that, so were the moral values and duties that we see today, like love and justice and mercy. They say it just exists with no foundation, no basis. Well, what would our response be? Our response would be, this is unintelligible. It doesn't make sense. What does it mean to say that justice, a value like justice, just exists? What does that even mean? We can say that a person is just, right? For instance, Batman. We can say that Batman is just. He's a person. He has that property of being just. But it's difficult, in fact, it's impossible to fathom justice, the abstraction of justice kind of just existing in the ether. You know, and you can kind of take a swipe at it and say, oh, I have some justice. No, that doesn't make sense. There has to be a foundation. And moral values seem to be properties of persons. Like I said, we all can be just or unjust at certain points in time. Now, let's give the atheist the benefit of the doubt. Let's say, okay, moral values just exist. I'll give you that. Well, you're going to have a difficult problem, Mr. Atheist, describing where moral duties come from if moral values just exist. For instance, let's just picture for a moment this kind of nebulous cloud here, and it represents justice. It means that, so justice exists, the concept of justice. Well, even if that were so, under an atheistic view, how is the fact that that cloud of justice existing, how is that going to obligate me to be just? Is that kind of abstraction of justice going to tell me to be just? How is it going to impose an obligation to me? It's impossible. It just exists. And presumably, on the atheistic view, not only do moral values like love, justice, and mercy exist, but the opposites also exist. Hatred, greed, injustice. Those would also exist because we experience them on a daily basis. So what's going to obligate me to choose one over the other? It seems that I can just be random and do what I want. There's no obligation, even if I were to give them the benefit of the doubt that these abstractions just exist without a foundation. They still have a problem to solve. So it doesn't seem that this view, by the way, that we're talking about, it's called moral realism. So R-E-A-L-I-S-M. It just says that moral values are real. That's it. You know, they just exist. No foundation. So it seems that moral realism also suffers from real philosophical problems. So that one, they only have one option left. And this last option that Mr. Atheist has to try to justify moral values and duties, it's called humanism. Who in here has heard of the term humanism? Okay, a good number of us. So humanism is basically the view, and it was very popular, and it might still be, it's probably not as popular today, but it was very popular, I know, in the 80s. Secular humanism, one of the probably the founder of one of the societies was Paul Kurtz. And so humanism is a view that man is the measure of all things. Man is the ultimate reality. And whatever contributes to the human flourishing is good. That's where your moral values come in. Whatever contributes to human flourishing is good, and whatever detracts from it is bad. So it's kind of like this utilitarianism. You know, you want to maximize the greatest amount of good for the greatest amount of people. So in this view, man is the foundation for moral values rather than God. Man replaces God as the foundation for moral values. And then moral duties, the obligations, come from the things that promote human flourishing. So, for instance, me eating an apple a day, right? You've heard apple a day keeps the doctor away. Well, it's a good thing, and it promotes human flourishing. I live longer if I eat an apple a day. Well, that now becomes a moral duty because it promotes human flourishing. So it's very pragmatic, but that's the view of humanism, is that man has now replaced God as the foundation for moral values and duties. Well, you know, at first glance, this worldview, it seems attractive. You know, humanists are, I know a couple of humanists, and they're very good people. And I've seen, you know, debates with humanists, and they seem like very, very good people. They're very involved in charity because they're really trying to promote the flourishing of human beings. So you'll see them involved in charity work, helping the poor, being in the hospitals, the widows and the orphans and stuff like that. These are very nice people. And so it makes this worldview attractive because it's so pragmatic. You can see the results very directly. But their underlying beliefs, the fact that man is a foundation for moral values, does this make sense? What would the Christian response be? What would the theist response be? And here it is. The fact that the first response would be, well, human flourishing as the stopping point for moral values, it seems very arbitrary. Remember, God does not exist. And under that view, we're all animals. It just so happens to be that humans or Homo sapiens are more evolved. They have the capability of reason, but they're still animals. And so it seems to me and a lot of other people that if you're a humanist, human flourishing seems an arbitrary stopping point for moral values. Given atheism, why think that human flourishing is more valuable than ant flourishing or tiger flourishing? Again, we're caught in that trap of speciesism. You're just choosing one arbitrarily one species over another. What makes you think that the flourishing of humans is morally valuable, more valuable than tiger flourishing or elephant flourishing? You're just arbitrarily choosing that. And so the atheist might just respond and say, well, it just is that way. Well, to me, that's a cop-out. You're not really giving reasons for your belief. You're kind of just asserting it, and you know, you're not even bothering to engage with the arguments or the underlying beliefs. So at that point, you can kind of tell that person, well, you're being intellectually dishonest. You're wanting me to be a reasonable person, but you yourself are not being reasonable when you're just saying it just is that way. They might also respond by saying, well, we are more evolved than those other species, right? And we kind of went through that. I can say, says who? That species may be less evolved in your eyes, but they might have the properties that are more acceptable for survival. You know, evolution is the name of the game. What makes you think that your survival rate is going to be greater than the other species' survival rate? Says who? Now, on the flip side, though, the theist, I think, has a good justification for believing that God is a stopping point for moral values. It seems to me that God is a natural stopping point as the foundation for objective moral values and duties. Because God, we know, is the ultimate reality. Historically, traditionally, God has always been known as the greatest conceivable being. And a being that is worthy of worship. Now, a being that is worthy of worship would have to be the highest good. The source of good. The foundation of all goodness. So God, it seems that he is the natural stopping point. It's not arbitrary that we say God is the source of all moral goodness and his commands obligate us to those moral duties. It's a natural stopping point. He's the ultimate reality. He's worthy of worship. So then, it seems given those responses to the humanist beliefs and then knowing that God is the natural stopping point, it seems that the humanist is the one that requires more faith than we do. Because remember, they're just arbitrarily choosing their stopping point and they're hoping they're right. But for the theist, for the Christian, we believe in a natural stopping point, and it makes sense. We have good reasons to believe that God would be the foundation for moral values and duties. So then, with premise one, if God does not exist, we showed that objective moral values and duties do not exist. Under the atheistic view that there is no God, it's impossible for them to really justify any objectivity for moral values and duties. Everything's fair game. Anything goes. But if God does exist, we do have objective moral values and duties. And we're going to talk about that in a little bit. So at this point, we'll take just a short little break. If anybody has any questions, feel free to ask them. All right. So this, we're starting on premise two. Objective moral values and duties do exist. Now, what you'll find interesting is that for premise one, remember, you want to pick premises that are believable, that are you're able to show that you have good reasons to believe. You don't want to pick premises that are like super difficult or just unreasonable. So for premise one, you'll find that at least in the academic level, maybe not on the street level, but in the academic level, you'll see a lot of professors who actually agree with this premise. They understand the implications of atheism. I mean, you can even go back in history and view famous atheists. Friedrich Nietzsche was a big one. He understood that if God was out of the equation, if God did not exist, then morality would just cease to exist. It was a free-for-all. Jean-Paul Sartre, Albert Camus, these are famous philosophers that understood that if God does not exist, Objective moral values and duties do not exist. And today, again, in the academic level at least, a lot of professors do agree with this premise. So I think we have pretty good reason to believe in the truth of premise one, and that we'll find a good reception with this premise. Now we move on to premise two. What good reasons do we have to believe that objective moral values and duties do exist? Now what's funny though, well, let me go through my notes and we'll come across it. It's interesting to consider this premise in light of the culture today. For instance, if you're going to go out in the street and you're doing street evangelism, or you're just talking to your friends or whatever, and you try to talk to them about morality, a lot of the time you'll find that a lot of people give lip service to relativism. Relativism is the view that truth and morals are relative to each person. So what's true for you may be true for you, but what's true for me is true for me. So we have two different truths. Or what may be good for you, that's fine. It may be bad for me, and that's okay. That's relativism. So they give lip service. You know, the big outcry these days for anybody is the word tolerance or judgmental. Stop judging. Stop being so judgmental. We have to be tolerant of other people's views. And what they really mean when they say such a thing is tolerant, the actual word, what it means is to put up with a differing view or a view that you disagree with. That's what it really means. But in today's culture, when they say the word tolerant, what they mean is, no, you have to accept that view as true while also accepting your view as true. So you're basically accepting that everybody's opinion is true. So if the atheist wants to say God exists, and I come along as a Christian and say, you know what, I disagree with you, and here are my reasons why. And then the atheist might say, you're being very intolerant right now. Why are you coming against me and trying to impose your beliefs on me? That's very intolerant. I'm like, well, first, tolerance means that I disagree with your view, but I agree with your right to have that view. But I disagree with it. I think you're wrong, but I acknowledge that you have the right to have that view. But the atheist, when he uses the word, or people these days, they think what they mean is, my view is right, you think your view is right, have a good day. You know, let's not talk about it. So, a lot of people will give lip service to relativism, but surprisingly though, you know, you just bring up a few illustrations and all of a sudden these same people who give lip service to relativism, you will get them to believe in objective moral values and duties. And some illustrations that you can probably bring up, of course, is the Holocaust. You ask them, well, let me ask you this. If you really believe that morals are relative or truth is relative, was the Holocaust objectively wrong? Was the Holocaust wrong? Do you believe that? And they say, oh, of course. 6 million Jews getting wiped off the planet in such a grotesque manner? So you believe that it was wrong and that everybody should have this belief. And I've actually talked to a person who was a hardliner and they said, you know what? I believe that, but somebody else may believe something differently. You're like, wow. But more often than not, you'll come across the person that says, yeah, I believe that that was wrong for everyone. So anyone who comes across and says the Holocaust was right, we believe that person is messed up, right? Another illustration you could probably bring up is, you ask them, well, do you believe it's wrong to torture children for the fun of it? I don't see any case where you can torture children at all, but this is usually the way the question is brought up. Do you believe it's wrong to torture children? I don't think you shouldn't get a person who ever says, well, it depends, you know. No, they will say, wow, that is awful. Yeah, I believe that that is wrong. Well, is that wrong just for you? What if I wanted to torture children? Is it wrong just for you? Or would you want to go and tell me that I'm wrong?
Ooh. How about if it's wrong for me to torture your children?
Right. And that's the good one. When try to use illustrations that will touch them directly. One of the illustrations I saw is this actually happened in a forum where a Christian apologist was giving a presentation, and a lady stood up and she yelled. You know, she was just like, "You have no right to impose your beliefs on me. There is no objective moral values and duties." And he said, "Well, let me ask you this. Say you're walking through Central Park at night and an attacker tries to sexually assault you. Would you want me at that moment to impose my morals on him?" So now it just turned personal. It's easy to think that morals are relative when it doesn't affect you. But now when you start thinking of, well, situations that involve me directly, then, you know, the tables turn and you start thinking differently. All of a sudden you turn into a moral realist, or rather an objective moral, a believer in objective morality when it starts dealing with you directly. So it'd be good to come up with illustrations, you know, right there on the spot when you're talking to somebody, well, that claims to be a moral relativist. Just come up with illustrations that attack them directly, like Ian brought up. Well, let me ask you, would it be okay if I torture your children, or if I were to murder your entire family, stuff like that? Would you try to impose your beliefs on me? Now, watch out. You don't want to be intolerant now, under your view. You can tell them that. So, again, even though many people give lip service to moral relativism, the moment you bring up illustrations like this, all of a sudden, I'm a moral objectivist. I believe in objective moral values and duties. But these illustrations that I just brought up, they only go so far. They only really talk about what people believe about moral values and duties. The question before us is, do we have any good reasons to show that they actually exist? I believe we do. And one reason that we can give is we can actually point to our moral experience. Our moral experience. For instance, whenever we witness injustice firsthand, so say somebody's getting robbed, somebody's getting assaulted, we get riled up. All of a sudden, our heart starts pumping and we feel that some injustice has occurred and we want to right that wrong. We may want to participate in making justice in undoing that injustice. We get riled up. Or even whenever we listen to stories on the evening news, our heart sinks. You know, every time you hear about corner store getting robbed or somebody getting shot in the street, our heart sinks. But why is this? Well, just like our experience with our five senses, so that's just our experience with the external world, we can make a case for our moral experience. So think about it this way. Yes, our five senses may be infallible. So for instance, I'll pick on Cheryl and Chris a little bit. You guys have, and Kat, and man, everybody has glasses. Jeez. You guys have glasses, okay? So if you were to take those glasses off, depending on how bad your vision is, and I were to tell you to read that sign across the street, say Dairy Queen or whatever, some of you, if you didn't know it was a Dairy Queen, you'd be like, I see shades of red, shades of white, but I really don't know what it is. And I told you, well, just give a guess. Some of you would give wrong guesses. Some of you might get lucky and guess Dairy Queen. But that means that your senses are infallible. I mean, your senses are fallible, right? Your five senses. Sometimes your sense of smell may be deceiving you. You know, I don't know if sometimes it happens where you're like, man, something smells good. And then the person next to you is like, man, it smells like gasoline. I don't know what you're talking about. Your sense of touch may be deceiving you. I know it used to be a popular Halloween game where you would stick your hand in a box and everything would be all mushy and you think it's like a human brain or something, but then it's just like spaghetti, you know? So your senses start deceiving you. Your senses are fallible. But just because they are fallible, it doesn't mean that I have to reject the reality of the external world, right? Just because I can't see the sign without my glasses, it doesn't mean that's it. The entire world doesn't exist. I can't trust my senses at all for anything ever. That you don't do that. That's unreasonable. In the same way with our moral experience, so whenever I experience injustice, whenever I experience sadness at something having gone wrong, even though my moral experience may be fallible, my moral sense may be fallible, I don't distrust the reality of a moral objectivity. Let me say that again. Let me try to use better words here. In the absence of any good reason to distrust my senses, I should trust what my moral senses are telling me, namely that some things are objectively evil, or good, or right, or wrong. In the absence of any reason, any good reason to distrust my senses, just like my five senses, I should trust what my moral senses, my moral experiences are telling me. Some things are objectively good and bad, right or wrong. And this is a really powerful argument. Because if you're talking to an atheist at this point, and they tell you, and they start going down the line that, well, our senses, you know, mess us up all the time. So what makes you think that, you know, you have the answers to all of life's questions about morals and stuff like that? So, and look, I'm not saying I do. But if you want to go down this line of reasoning, Mr. Atheist, that I can't trust my moral experience, then you are going to have to be intellectually honest and say, because your five senses are not are fallible, then the same way that you're trying to discard my moral experiences, you're going to have to discard your experience of the external world. And I don't think you want to go there. That's where it gets them. That's where the force of the argument is. If you start going down the road of distrusting your senses, they don't want to go to that obvious conclusion. And so you can, that's where the force of the argument is felt. Of course, there are those who truly don't believe in objective good or evil, right or wrong. This was the kind of person that I was talking about earlier who actually said, well, yeah, the Holocaust, I believe it's wrong, but some people are out there that believe, you know, they have their own beliefs, and if they think it's good, it's okay. Now, we would view these people as exceptions to the rule. You know, they would be the moral equivalent of a blind person. They're lacking in some one of the senses. So we would say, you know what, their moral compass or moral sense, sensory, is messed up at that point. They don't really have the full capacity of telling what is right from wrong, good or bad. Let's get back here. We're talking about our moral experience, right? So we said, just like our five senses, we can trust the existence of the external world, that my moral experience points to the existence of an actual, like, objective moral values and duties. So I have no good reason to distrust my moral experiences, so I'm justified in believing that objective moral values and duties do exist. Well, somebody might come along and say, you know, Mr. Atheist might come along and say again, well, hey, remember biological evolution and social pressures? Certainly, those two factors would come along and, you know, that makes morality subjective. People have different morals because evolution, right? Evolution is just random creation, that's for lack of a better word. So one person can evolve into having one set of morals. Another person can evolve into having another set of morals. Therefore, morality is subjective. What about that, Mr. Theist? Well, what would our response here be? I would tell that person, you know what? Unfortunately for you, Mr. Atheist / relativist, you're confusing, again, belief with what actually is. And this is the way they do it. The evolutionary description, when you try to bring in, well, evolution has brought up different morals, all that describes is how we got our beliefs. So evolution, given atheism, assuming atheism, evolution has created people with different moral beliefs, but that does nothing to say about the actual existence of objective morality. It just means that people evolve to have different beliefs. And what's funny is that this is actually the genetic fallacy. This is an informal fallacy. When you're trying to say that a belief is wrong by showing where or how it originated, you're saying your belief about morality is wrong because you evolved. We all evolved. Morality is subjective. Well, that only... you're just talking about the belief. You're confusing the belief with objective morality itself. So it doesn't help your case, Mr. Atheist. We could have come to our beliefs through reading a book or looking at a message on a, you know, in a fortune cookie. I could have, you know, gathered my moral beliefs through any means. But it does nothing to say about the actual existence of objective moral values and duties.
So are you saying that atheist has the argument of specific difference in morals of people because of their evolution, but the theist argument is, well, you're looking at specific examples as opposed to morality as a scale of right or wrong, not what is right or wrong by definition.
The difference with between the belief and the actuality of the morals, that is the crucial difference that I think it would behoove us to really understand, to really detect when skeptics are bringing up this kind of reasoning. It happens a lot. Even in the beginning of the study today, when we said, can we be good without God? And then I said, it's inevitable you're going to come across people who are going to say, yeah, I'm good without believing in God. So they're confusing the belief with the actual existence. It happens all the time. And this is a classic example right here where they're saying evolution has created, for lack of a better word again, different morals. You see different morals in different cultures. And I'll say, well, no, you see different moral beliefs, you see different moral perceptions, you see different ways of exhibiting morality, but it does nothing to say about whether or not an actual objective moral value or duty exists. You're just talking about the way people interact with this moral system. So it's really crucial, I think, that we learn to understand, kind of really dissect the language of the skeptic. Because more often than not, when you're meaning one thing, they're talking about another. And one of the key ones is the difference between the belief about something and the actual existence. So yeah, this evolutionary claim or in social pressures, it only talks about beliefs, you know, not the actual existence. That's a genetic fallacy. Now, what's funny about this is, okay, Mr. Atheist, you want to take this route? Let's go down this route. Let's see the logical outcome. You're saying that evolutionary processes and social pressures have brought us to this point where we have different morals, and therefore we can't trust our moral experience. We can't trust our moral experience. We can't justify the fact that there's objective morality. Well, let's take this a step further, Mr. Atheist. If what you're saying is true, then we can't justify, we can't trust knowledge at all. We can't justify anything. We can't trust anything at all. Because evolution, of course, evolved us to a point where even our knowledge, everyone's knowledge on this planet Earth, is different from everyone else's. So how can I trust even my own thoughts? How can I trust my own beliefs about anything? In fact, you can't even trust your skeptical claim about there being different moral values, because that belief was brought about by evolution itself. So you can't even trust that. you want to go down this route? Okay. You have to come to grips with the fact that you cannot have any trust in any knowledge at all. So what are you going to do there? Well, hopefully they'll be like, oh, you know, okay. Let's take a step back. Let's think about this some more.
Yeah, but can't they just agree with you at that point, but not come back to the higher...
Yeah, I mean, they can agree with you, but at that point, they have to, at the very least, stop using that argument and look for a better one. But I would encourage them. It makes... Theism makes more sense. It explains more and explains it better. So... That's really the end of it, is where we have good reason to believe in premise two, that objective moral values and duties exist. Based on our moral experience, I have no good reason to distrust my moral experience, just like my five senses. And then the objections that were brought up by Mr. Atheist, they don't stand up philosophically or practically. So I think we're justified in believing the truth of premise two. And also we're justified in holding to the truth of premise one. And like we said earlier, when we have good reasons to believe premise one and premise two, then we can say logically, it follows that God exists. There has to be a foundation, transcendent, personal, unchanging foundation for moral values and duties. And that is what we would call God. And so the atheist has to come to grips with this. And that's why I said it's very effective. It's logically airtight. We have very good reasons. The objections that are going to be brought up, these common objections, and you'll see some on your study guide that are at the end of your study guide sheet. Those they don't stand up. They've been used for years and years and years, and still there has been no good answer from the atheist to really bring down this type of argument. So I think we're justified as Christians in believing that because we have objective moral values and duties, therefore God exists.